Did you miss us? It's the TV Talk Machine. We went away for a week, but now we're back for an extra week. And I am Jason Snell. Still, I went away, but now I'm back. And your host, Chief TV Critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Tim Goodman, is also back. Hi.
Hi. And I wish I had gone away somewhere else, but didn't. I don't know.
Yeah, well, like that. You'll find a way to get away soon, I suspect.
Yeah, I'm gonna find a way.
But I went to Austin, Texas, and had some barbecue.
Oh, I'm going there next month for ATX.
Oh, nice, very nice. Yeah. I want to go there for ATX sometime. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yes, queso and beer.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
TV.
Oh man, it was all good. Good meat, good cheese, good beer.
Yeah,
the whole thing. Just,
yes.
That is
did
a great
you visit
place.
Friends, what did you do?
Bachelor party, basically.
Oh.
I have a friend who's getting married who decided to invite like a dozen people he knows to go to Austin for a couple of days, and that was fun.
Were you able to see Moises?
I did not see Moises because I was leaving just as he was getting back from someplace. So I had to get meat from other locals who did provide us with fine.
He's the master of the local meat.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. Well, we delegated that to other locals who did a fine job. We got some good brisket. Literally my favorite food is that barbecue Texas style brisket, and it was awesome.
So good.
One of these days I'll go to ATX. I would love to do that sometime.
Yes.
One day.
No doubt.
Someday. They always have it right around when Apple's doing its developer conference. That makes it extremely inconvenient for me.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have a lot to talk about. And I want to talk about cancellations because there's a lot going on there. But I think we should start with like doing some 2 weeks gone. We got a bunch of stories to get through of other things you've done. I noticed somebody asked about Patrick Melrose, the Benedict Cumberbatch show. I thought we talked about it last week, but somebody who is a regular listener asked what you thought of it. Your review is up. I'll put it in the show notes. But you liked it.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. In fact, I got contacted by the Metacritic people because there was some discussion that they had put a too low of a tag on it, our number 80, they put 80 on it, and I agreed that it needed to be higher, so it moved it to 90. So a very positive review. I think, but it was just, you know, I think they were getting hung up on the fact that I was saying it's kind of a simple story. I mean, it's basically linear in that someone gets messed up as a child and then it screws them up into their adult life. There's not much mystery beyond that. And it's just how Benedict Cumberbatch plays that part and shows the sort of the sorrow and humanity, but also tons of dark comedy and funny material in this really troubling piece. But yeah, it's great. Everybody should watch it.
Yeah. And so that's Patrick Melrose. You also reviewed Motherland. What should we know about that?
What we should know about Motherland is that we should skip it.
Skip it. It's on Sundance now, so you got to have the Sundance streaming channel anyway to get it. And
yeah,
you say skip it.
Skip it. The short of it is that it's the excitement was Sharon Horgan from Catastrophe, and you know she's just so great. She is one of four writers on this. I'm believing a co-creator of it as well. But it's just about parenting, motherhood in particular. But it's about parenting, and it's too forced. You know, there's a lot of rich material there. It's hard to do a series because it's pretty well trampled ground. But in this case, her and the other writers just push every scenario to its maximum, and it just feels hard to watch because it's too. You know, the mom is too frantic. The situations are too bent for laughter. And so I did not like it.
All right. Well, we'll give it a pass.
Yeah. Easy pass.
All right. So let's move on to some of your other pieces that you've written in the last couple of weeks that are worth talking about a little bit. And people should also check them out at HollywoodReporter.com. I like this one. TV's next fresh ideas might lie in its past, which is a nice headline that somebody wrote for you to say, essentially, here's five shows, more or less, that I would like. I would like to see the revival, reimagining, rebooting of on TV that you thought that like there's something in the premise or something about it that why not make a modern version of this show.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect column for us because all of these have been sort of basically workshopped on here on TVTM over the years. And so, yeah, I was basically saying, you know, it's not a response to Roseanne or whatever, but I just don't need, I don't need reboots. I mean, today we, Fox canceled Brooklyn Nine-Nine and brought back Last Man Standing, the Tim Allen thing from ABC. And that's, you know, that's basically just revival more right. than rebooting. But I'm about, I don't like those. You know, reimagining things. And so I picked five series that we should be reimagined.
All right. And you're right. We have touched on some of these on the mm-hmm. show before. Courtship of Eddie's Father. I like this. This is the idea that was the Bill Bixby comedy about a guy whose wife had died and he was raising his little kid, Eddie, and, mm-hmm. you know, balancing a career and kind of being back out in the dating life. And you sort of see that as you can do that as a drama or maybe even a dramedy of the idea of a single dad trying to kind of cope with raising his son and figuring out how to can he have a personal life.
Yeah, and the meat of that series was in the seriousness of it. It wasn't in the comedy. There was comedy sidelights, you know, but the meat of it was in the seriousness. It was definitely ahead of its time. And I think that it would have to stay that that way. The focus would definitely best be put on sort of it doesn't have to be super dramatic, but it has to be less jokey. It can't be Motherland or Fatherland in this instance.
How about Northern Exposure? We give that a lot of play on this podcast, but I think you're right. This is such a great just concept of, you know, fish out of water in a wild location, Alaska in this case, even though they shot it, you know, in, I think they did their exteriors in the Northwest, in like mm-hmm. Seattle or something like that. But you know, bring back that concept. It's a fun concept, and nobody has tried.
Yeah, I mean, Courtship of Eddie's Father and Northern Exposure were like my one and two that we've talked about here on the TVTM. When people have said, "What would you guys bring back?" Those were, I mean, we've had picks before in the past. Before, I think you picked X-Files before they even rebooted X-Files,
right?
And you know,
they revived it. I wanted them to reboot it.
Yeah. You wanted to reimagine it, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, basically I wanted new cast members and forget all of the old continuity is what I was going for.
I should say that I actually went back in I went back in the top of this article. I basically try to get to this point because we use reboot and revival and all this stuff so loosely. The reboot really means restarted or revived. So basically, Will and Grace, Roseanne, and today, Last Man Standing, those are all reboots because they are being restarted and revived. And I think what you wanted was a reimagining of X-Files, which we did not get. We got a reboot, and I want reimagining of Courtship of Eddie's Father. Northern Exposure. The weird thing about Northern Exposure is, though, it's still kind of fresh. It ended in 1995. Is that Joshua Brand and John Falzi are still around, and Brand is like a consulting producer on The Americans, so he's super current. I bet those guys would love, and they're legends. They did St. Elsewhere, I'll Fly Away. They could totally take a stab at redoing this. I think you have to recast it. I think you can keep it in Sicily, fictional Sicily, Alaska, but I think you could recast it and maybe add some different characters, change up some genders, and it would be really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there's a rich vein there for Northern Exposure to tap if they, you know, they should give us a call. Larry Sanders, you mentioned, I think this is really interesting, this idea of the intersection of television and talk and other kinds of televised entertainment and, you know, being able to do a fictionalized kind of commentary about it with characters who are living in that world.
Yeah, again, these are, I think I've said at the top of this story, when people can see when they read it, is that I said, you know, some of these, like, the ideas of these shows are really great. And a lot of times there's nothing like these ideas currently on television. I would love to see Larry Sanders redone. I mentioned that if Colbert wasn't actually a talk show host himself, a real one, he'd be perfect as a fake talk show host. And with real guests, with real celebrities. I mean, it's such a brilliant premise. It needs to be redone, and I'm hoping it does.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Now, Tina Angst, you mentioned a couple of shows, My So-Called Life, of course, and the one that people don't necessarily remember, but was just as groundbreaking in the 70s, James at 15, James at 16, the idea of like taking an actual hard look at real teen life, with the real, you know, the real issues and the real anxieties, and have, we see some of this in TV now, and you mentioned something like Skins. I think the UK version of Skins tried to do something like this, but having a really be real issues involving teenagers and what they're going through today.
Yeah, and that's a tough one because there is a lot of coming of age stories, and some of them are done really well. Some of them were not done very well, but there's a lot of them. There's no lack for this kind of thing. But I was saying, like, you know, there's like, it's a perfect opportunity for LGBT plus leads. And it's a perfect exploration of a life led that way. That'd be amazing. I think a lot of shows that are trying to do these kind of things are either funny or sensational, like 13 Reasons Why. And I think funny, it can only be a side product. I don't think it should be, because when you try to be too snarky, like the rebooted Heathers or reimagined Heathers, I think, you're undercutting what you can achieve with the drama. And I that's what I noted. There's too much comedy there, then there's, you know, or there's exploitation. If you just approach it head on, I think you could do some real good work.
Okay, and then it's the something we have talked about before. I like how you played it into a reimagined angle here. But basically what you're saying is there should be a show about music that's good. And Love Monkey was pretty good, and it died on CBS. And then there was Roadies and Vinyl, both of which had their issues. Cameron Crowe kind of like made the frustrating failure, as you say. And Vinyl was a mess. So, but what you want to say is, like, look, keep trying. There is something here.
Yeah, and really, in all of them, they're brilliant concepts. Like, Vinyl is the best concept by far. You know, it's New York in 1973. You have this connection, all these roads are linking up together between, you know, old standard rock and roll, you know, meets punk rock and new wave and hip hop. And disco, it's just that year, that era is like perfect mishmash of all these styles. They just handle it badly. Roadies is also a great premise of following the road crew and a band. It was just done poorly. And Love Monkey as an A&R guy, which is kind of what is at the root of Vinyl. That was just, I was just like, you know what? The thing about Love Monkey, it didn't matter about, it was based on a book that was mostly about dating, but his day job was more interesting to me. And I just want, as you said, I want a really good series about music, and it needs to be done. And all three of these are great ideas in some way. So either remake them all or reimagine them all, or some combination of just a really good show.
Right. Mine those for raw material and come up with your own new one if you want,
exactly.
But just get in there. That's fair. Another piece that you wrote, another list piece. I like this, though. This is the hidden gems in the age of peak TV. I think we mentioned this last time that you were working on this. And what I'm amused by is that it's, in this case, hidden in England.
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, you're right. It's hidden in England. So yeah, you know, it's funny because, I thought the first thing, I actually imagined the first thing you were going to say was, well, I would hope that you would think it was a good idea, but I thought you were going to say, is this going to be something like, your mock draft premise that is not actually recurring when you say it's going to be recurring? But no, I am going to, definitely stick to this. I'm going to try to do one or two of these a month. Certainly one at the minimum.
You're not going to run out, right? There are so many shows that people don't know about that are great that you can keep. I think it's great. This is a way to get the light shined on those shows that have kind of come and gone, and they're in the catalog and you can still watch them and spotlight them. So I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, and then I won't have to do the preamble. I mean, I loved writing the little preamble to this, which I won't have to do this in the next time I do it. But it was basically like, why? Because I could only imagine people saying, well, that's not a hidden gem. Everybody knows the show. It's not true. And I sort of highlighted everybody's level of awareness about television, which goes from almost nothing to maybe people on our podcast and like-minded folks who are really connected who are pretty much in touch with everything. So it runs the gamut. And so, yeah, I ticked off three shows that we're familiar with here on the podcast.
Yeah, so it's Detectorists.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. The A Word. Yes.
Yes.
And one that people listening to the podcast will maybe remember, which is Back, which you put in your top rankings last year. This is Mitchell and Webb with Simon Blackwell from Veep and In the Loop and Thick of It and Peep Show and all that, like got them back together mm-hmm. for this show, which, you know, a lot, which nobody's heard of.
It's on
Sundance. Yeah,
it's on. It started on Sundance Now, and then they've actually moved it, I think, to Sundance. So you can watch. I think
Sundance
you can watch
proper,
it on both.
As they might say.
Well, Sundance proper. I had a nice little retweet from Simon Blackwell this morning about this. He's brilliant, and this series is like it's so good. You know, yeah, and that's actually probably a good example of maybe even people on our podcast haven't heard of it, other than. You know, when we talked about it and honestly that it came in pretty late, I think at the tail end of 2017. But I ranked it number 4 out of 46 and, it, you know, it's just, not only is it funny, it is kind of like a masterclass of like having like a narrative, and not having everything be jokey, like kind of like Motherland, just to circle back to something we talked about earlier, but to have a narrative that there's actually a plot and a story, which you don't see that much in comedies. And that the plotting and the crafting and how the characters change as they go on this trip, is I think part of the appeal because it's amazingly creative, but also just really funny. Like, you know, people say, oh, I laughed so hard I cried. I literally cried in this show. There were a couple scenes, but there was one in particular where I was like crying. I just, the tears were coming out of my eyes and I kept replaying it and laughing at just, cause once you get going, there's no stopping. And I, to this day, it's a great scene. I love it.
Awesome. All right. Now we should move on to the big topic, which it's funny. You wrote a piece about canceling TV shows, like on cable and streaming, the new normal, like what makes a show keep or cancel. And it's different than in the old days and looking at network ratings for network shows. So we'll start there. There are a couple high profile cancellations that we need to talk about, but I wanted to start with your piece in the Hollywood Reporter about this. What prompted you to write this and what are you thinking in terms of what the new normal is now?
Well, it's, you know, it's funny because, you know, we talk a lot about Netflix, especially of late. They've been doing so many things. And then we're always like, oh, so what, you know, people are trying to read the tea leaves about what gets renewed and what doesn't over there. And it's just really difficult, you know, and it's only been in the last year, maybe in the last, 8 months that they've actually started like canceling more shows and doing it quicker. So there had been this, and everybody has their own. They have their own, I guess, not algorithm, but their bar, whatever their bar for renewing a series is different at each place. But there are some consistencies that I was seeing. And so when HBO canceled Here and Now with Tim Robbins and Holly Hunter, I mean, those are big stars. And it's at HBO. HBO has a history of being patient with things unless they're spectacular failures. And so, you know, I started thinking about a bunch of other things that I was surprised either got a second year or, you know, like, for example, The Chi on Showtime. I mean, I kind of knew it would, but it didn't do nearly as well or had the buzz that I think Showtime wanted. Their other one, I'm Dying Up Here, again, didn't really have buzz. I kind of laughed when I remembered, or actually almost didn't remember before press time, that AMC actually has a series called The Sun, S-O-N, and has renewed it. And I was like, wait, what? What? And then I looked and I remember, oh, yes, I didn't have to review it, but I was like, what? Okay, boy, talk about not being part of the zeitgeist at all. you know, like none. And the same was true for Here and Now on HBO. So I started to get into like trying to put together an exploration of this inexact science of how these cable in particular and streaming channels are saying, what do we do? And I also Snowfall on FX makes me laugh. But I think, Jason, that what I tried to come to was that they're all put in a really difficult situation because of our modern times. If you're a cable channel and you're not a streamer, you almost have to give every show that's decent or gets critically acclaimed, a second season, because that first season then goes to the streaming outlet, right?
Right.
And it gets discovered by everybody who's sort of late, which is a topic that we've talked about many, many times. Mm-hmm. And I did again today in my Hidden Gem story, is everybody's behind. There is no one's like on the same page. And so you have to wait, because what if, and it's proven out time and again, that people will discover new or cable shows on their streaming services and say, oh, I'd like to see second season of this now that I'm caught up. And so it's almost changed it. Like I came to the conclusion that if you get canceled in the first year, you well and truly sucked, because that means no one watched it and the critically acclaimed stuff was not happening. Because the bulk of things fall into the second season, where you kind of have to, like, let's wait and see. And then you're a success if you make it into the third season.
Yeah, I feel like if you don't make it out of the first season, it's failed the test of the executives, right? Like, mm-hmm. they saw it and they're like, oh, this is no good. Right. Well, we'll put it on. We paid for it. And mm-hmm. maybe people will watch it, and maybe somebody will champion it. And maybe we're wrong. And then you look and you see, no, we weren't wrong. Nobody championed it. Now it's gone. Right. Like, I feel like it's gotta be that double failure. And mm-hmm. then it's just out after one. But yes. Otherwise you gotta keep it around. It's ironically, I'm going to mention one of the shows that just got canceled, which is The Expanse on Sci-Fi. Like, that was, I felt like there was a groundswell of interest in that show once it went on streaming. And, you know, there are plenty of other examples like that where somebody misses the show and then it hits on streaming and people discover it. And then you've got a convert and they're ready for the second season when it drops, wherever it drops. So, like, we see this time and again, people are distracted. They may not see that first season. It may be word of mouth. And the beauty of the streaming world we live in is if it's parked somewhere, if your first season is parked somewhere where people can see it, and that's the key. If it isn't, that's bad. But if right. it's parked somewhere, then for the next 9 months or whatever, as the second season is in production, you are able to get every little bit of word of mouth, every angle, every article written by you saying you should check this out. Like, all of those things start to build. People talk about it, and you end up with building a bigger audience so that season two has more viewers than season one did. And, like, that is the model. It doesn't always happen, but, like, it's a totally viable model, because people are going to miss it first time out and they're going to have to get that kind of echo of the word of mouth that will let them thrive.
Right. And I think I'm going to let you talk about this, to talk a little bit about Expanse. Oof. Because, you know, when I did this piece that we're talking about, the hard part was sort of assembling all these examples and then studying, like, what happened, like, why did it not go, or why did it go, and why would it go? And there's all these, or why it makes sense to bring it back. There's all these variables, and you almost don't see it in series that go 3 and 4, because they're considered successes at that point. If you're on for 3 seasons, I think you're a success. If you get into your 4th season, like Casual did, then it's great. And then you have a natural ending. I talked about how the old tool rules always had 5 seasons. That's out the window now. You don't have to have 5 seasons anymore. You can be perfectly fine, like Casual on Hulu, and go 4 seasons. People still probably don't know that show. They'll find it at some point. But I think The Expanse is a complete, is like, I didn't even get to that in this article. It's a completely different set of reasons why today it was canceled, right?
Yeah. And I think actually The Expanse, we'll see where this story goes, but The Expanse cancellation is fascinating to me because it strikes me as being something that is caused by the modern TV landscape, and and it, we almost feels like the landscape shifted and the deal that was made to get it on the air suddenly seemed like a worse deal for all mm-hmm. concerned. Yeah. And so Sci-Fi has walked away, and they wouldn't walk away necessarily if the ratings were better, right? But the ratings aren't great. They're okay. But it's not produced by Universal, which owns Sci-Fi Channel as an NBC Universal channel. So it's not an owned and operated product. It is from Alcon mm-hmm. Entertainment. They're the ones who sold it to Sci-Fi. There are apparently specific issues with streaming rights. Like, Sci-Fi has first run linear rights in the U.S., but they don't have other rights. Like, I get the impression that, like, when it goes on various services later for streaming, like, it's on, the first 2 seasons are on Amazon, I think Sci-Fi doesn't get a cut of that, I think. And there's some other really weird fallout about this. For example, example, unlike almost every other U.S. show that is shown overseas on Netflix, where it seems the new normal is the show airs, let's say Sunday night on U.S. TV, and then Monday it's on Netflix worldwide, or maybe Tuesday it's on Netflix worldwide for everybody else outside the U.S. The Expanse, it wouldn't get on Netflix. It's on Netflix most of the world, not in Canada, but in most of the world it's on Netflix. It wouldn't drop its season until the complete season had aired in the U.S., and then there was a buffer of a few weeks, and then Netflix would drop the whole thing. I gotta believe that's contractual. I gotta believe that Sci-Fi Channel said, well, we'll give you this money, but we want to crowd everybody else out in terms of exclusive broadcast, and we don't want any streaming going up against it. As a result, though, it's got to be an incredibly pirated show, right? So it's actually Netflix is probably not getting the viewership it would want to get, because people who are super fans are going to download it. They're going to pirate it, because it's going to be, what, 3 months before it shows up on Netflix. So nobody's happy here, it sounds like, where Sci-Fi doesn't own enough of it. Netflix doesn't own enough of it. And so it's this child with no parents. It's just kind of out there. And in the Deadline.com story about this that broke this news, two interesting things. One is it specifically cites the Sci-Fi deal with the production company, which is involves this, like, what rights they get and what rights they don't get, because they want to have a comprehensive, we talked about this, a comprehensive strategy where you've got your, it's up on streaming and it's also on broadcast, and you've got this kind of whole package. And they didn't own the whole package at Sci-Fi. They only owned pieces of it, and pieces of it were retained by the production company. So they're less motivated. It may be, you know, honestly, maybe it doesn't pencil out for them. Maybe the money they're spending, they can't recoup it in certain areas. And they're like, why are we doing this? We don't even own this show. It's somebody else's show. Why are we in business with them? It's not a huge hit. We have no other things to motivate us. Let's let it go. So there's that. Also, this story dropped with a quote from Alcon Entertainment, the co-CEOs, saying, we respect their decision. We're going to shop it around, which we hear that a lot, right? Studios say that a lot, saying, well, you know, it's a bummer. We got canceled, but before we put it in the ground, we're going to take it around and you know, hope somebody else will save us. I look at this and think, well, of course they're going to find somebody else, because not only is it an acclaimed show and it has a pretty rabid fan base, but I feel like if they can get out of the old bad deal, that there maybe is a good deal to be made here. And Netflix seems to me to be the most logical answer here, because this is, by all rights, a Netflix show in most of the world. And Netflix itself was limited by the Sci-Fi deal. So whether that happens, maybe there are things we don't know about the contractual details of this. But I immediately saw this and thought, oh, maybe Netflix will finally get it everywhere and on time, instead of having to get it almost everywhere, but not in North America and late. It's possible, you know, they've obviously got a deal with Amazon for the first two seasons. So it's possible that that's another outlet for it. And I heard somebody point out, as Alan Sepinwall said a couple days ago, you know, Netflix is no longer really in the rescuing the cast-offs of other networks business anymore. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. We've talked about it too. That's kind of that era has passed, despite Arrested Development, you know, and a new season of that, which we haven't even talked about yet. Oh my God, we'll get there. So yes, I agree with that. But in this case, I kind of feel like The Expanse is kind of in the family. It's kind of Netflix already had a deal with them. It just wasn't for the U.S. rights. So we'll see what happens, and it would be a shame if the deal that made The Expanse come to be ended up dooming it after three seasons, because I think it's a great story and it's really well made, and I would like to see it continue. It would be a shame if the deal is sort of the thing that that killed it. But I'm still pretty hopeful, because I feel like with that deal unraveled, Alcon can probably make a better deal, a modern deal for the show, if the money works and if there's a market for it. But anyway, it's super weird, and how much more modern a cancellation could there be than having it be about streaming rights and
complicated by the fact that you had this structure of two U.S. based companies, or actually two, like, well, you know, they're international companies, had different rights deals,
right?
And then when the cable channel that originally signed the deal bails out, now you have two people who actually have the rights to some of the screening in different areas, thinking, okay, how are we together right. going to fix this.
How does this work? Yeah. And how is it that this deal, did they cheap out and not buy all the rights? Did Alcon do something that they thought was savvy and hold back some of the rights, but now it turns out that it's bit them? And again, this would all be solved if it was a bigger hit. It's not a big hit. It's not. But it does feel like with better terms, in better circumstances, it would work. I think also bottom line, like the Magicians gets better ratings than The Expanse. Not a lot, but it gets better ratings. But the key is the Magicians is made by Universal Television. And so it's in the family. They own everything. They've got all the rights. All the money stays within Comcast. And that is always going to, for any network, is going to give you a leg up if it's a homegrown show. Speaking of which, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, right? I don't believe Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a Fox-produced show, is it? I think it's a Universal-produced show.
Yeah, it is.
So again, you know, less motivation to keep the show around, and so Fox canceled Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah, it's and that one could resurface someplace else.
Sure,
I do, but it may or may not.
That seems like it's got Hulu written all over it, but it did do five seasons. So there's also there are lots of questions that fans don't ask that we aren't generally privy to, unless somebody like one of the really great reporters, The Hollywood Reporter, like Leslie Goldberg, digs into this and comes up with something. but like, it could also be that all of those actors have 5-year deals, and they looked at renewing their deals, and the costs were going to go up, and they couldn't make it, you know, they didn't want to pay it. Or I mean, there could be, I'm not saying there are those issues, but there could be lots of other things kind of bubbling under the surface. That said, it does feel kind of like it's got Hulu written all over it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, right? But yeah, it could happen.
But it is, that's a more understandable cancellation in the sense that it was, you know, like a lot of these sitcoms that that we've plugged over the years that are really nice and high quality. They don't always get the best ratings, and they get kept around for a while because they want to have a good relationship with the producers, and they have space to fill. Fox is going to be picking up NFL games this fall, so they've got fewer slots. So that's one of the mm-hmm. reasons that they can ditch something like this. It's run 5 years. They get more expensive as they go. I mean, I love Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but at 5 years of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I'm like, I feel like we're really lucky that we got 5 years of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. If that's all we get, that, you know, I feel like we did, you know, we did it, everybody. Like, that was, that they should take a victory lap. And if it comes back somewhere exactly. else, great.
I mean, that's the bottom line, right? I mean, people on comedies, people who are fans of these comedies, myself included, particularly animated ones, that's a little bit different animal, but applies as well. We're more open to multiple stories, even in multiple seasons, even after the sort of glow and the greatness is gone on these things. It fits like a glove, and it's fun, and it provides us a little bit of, you know, a little bit of like a block sort of to what's happening in the world. It's a little salve, a little joyful salve when there's war in the Middle East. So we let them go multiple seasons. But the fact of the matter is, these days, man, if you get we just talked about three as opposed to five, if you get a handful of seasons like Brooklyn Nine-Nine did, it's take the victory lap. Exactly.
Now I want to take you back in time.
Okay, let's go back.
This is episode 175, to episode 94
Ooh.
Of the TVTM 2016 Death March, where I called you at the Beverly Hilton, where you were in residence.
I was in residence. Mm-hmm.
August 2016. In this episode, you told me, and then you wrote about it on THR a little bit later, about how you talked to Mitch Hurwitz about Arrested Development season 4. And he had dropped the bomb on you that he had re-edited the entirety of season 4 into a standard 22-minute, 20-episode, or whatever it is, like linear, not weird kind of standalone cross narrative kind of things, but a linear narrative like the first three seasons. And it was sitting on a hard drive, and he had mentioned it to Netflix, and they're like, whatever. So flash forward to last week, Netflix announced, one, season 5 of Arrested Development is made and coming out later this month.
Yeah, May 29th.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I love that. All right. It's like, yeah, there is a season 5. We made it. It comes out later this month. It's like, oh, what?
That's so Netflix.
I know, right? But it's amazing. That's great. But here we go. As a promotion for that, what they did was they put up Mitch Hurwitz's remixed season 4 with kind of a statement like, hey, if you didn't like season 4 or you heard it was bad, try this one. It's more like seasons 1, 2, and 3, which if you are launching season 5 and you kind of want people to go back and binge through the archive, having a season 4 that doesn't feel weirdly out of place like the original season 4 did in terms of its format, maybe it's a good idea. Either way, we finally have gotten to see that thing that Mitch Hurwitz told you about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Which was, it was one of those, wait, what?
Are you serious? Maybe he's kidding. He's not kidding.
Yeah. And it was like, because it's one thing to say you're going to do it. And, you know, apparently he was on some obscure podcast, I think, in 2014, where he said he thought about the idea in 2014. That's the first time I'd ever heard of that. Certainly when I did mine in 2016, I remember tweeting that out in the ballroom and people were like, what? But to actually have it done, like he said, oh, I'm done. Yeah. I'm done. Not only am I done, Ron Howard has done the narration.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the weird stuff like that.
And they don't want it. So it's just going to sit there for who knows, maybe forever. And then a year and a half plus later, here it is. They did it as a part. I think not stupid, right? To like, oh, we're doing season 5 now. This is a great promotional vehicle for season 5.
Super smart.
Yeah.
Although now, of course, there's a pay dispute. No,
of course.
You know what? This is why we can't have good things.
Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm.
Yes, no good deed goes unpunished.
No, but anyway, I've talked to people. I watched part of one, and it felt like Arrested Development. I've seen different pieces where some people say, "Oh, it's so much better this way," and other people are like, "Eh, it wasn't that good a season anyway, and this doesn't make it much better." But it's all over the place. I haven't watched the whole thing, so I can't say. My daughter, who loves Arrested Development, has watched some of it, and she says it feels much more like Arrested Development, which I think is kind of the idea. Is just
make it
what if we made it like Mitch Hurwitz tried his kind of like Netflix style storytelling approach, and then he thought, how about the old way? What if we did it the old way? Would that look like? And that's what is there. The old version, by the way, is available, but it's in that trailers and more section that we uncovered many weeks ago,
right?
And it's not available on all platforms, but it is if you've got a trailers and more and you want to compare and contrast the season 4 stuff. The old season 4 is in the trailers and more section on Netflix.
And you can access that. Is it only on your streaming device, or how?
I think some stream. Like, I have Apple TV, and I can't see trailers and more. It doesn't show up. But if I go on like my computer, the trailers and more is there. And I think I can see it in the app. So I don't know. It's
oh my God.
Depends on where you are. You may or may not see, because that's where the season recaps are. That's why we discovered that thing.
That's why we never saw them before.
That's exactly right.
Two guys with Apple TV.
Yeah.
Totally blind.
There's a whole
the world.
Missing portion of Netflix we knew nothing about. Oh, by the way, I wanted to mention to those people who wrote in to say, I don't know what you're talking about. The Netflix interface is always the same for me. I don't know. I can't answer your question. All I can tell you is that we brought up Netflix two nights ago to watch something. And once again, everything moved. In this case, it was even worse. It launched and I could see the menu, but then it did like a relaunch where it reloaded the whole app and said, log in as who you are. And then I clicked through and suddenly the menu orders were completely different. And we couldn't find the show that we had been watching that we wanted to keep watching because it wasn't in the first like four rows. It's real, people. Netflix wants you to click around and have to play a game in order to find the shows you want to watch, and it drives me crazy. There it is.
That's smart.
Oh, there's so much, Tim. There's so much. You want to do some letters?
Let's do that.
All right. We are not canceled. We will keep doing letters. Here we are. This is from Tunza and the Five and Dime wrote this, and it's actually she forwarded it's a tweet by John Carroll, your former colleague at the Chronicle. You're both Chronicle alums, saying, was last night's, this is a little while ago, Homeland finale the most embarrassing series finale since forever. Tedious screenwriter bromides plus Phil. Have you seen the Homeland finale? You're off of Homeland, aren't you?
I'm off of it. Yeah, I'm way off of that.
Yeah, so we can't tell. That's the problem, is once you're off of a show, you know, you just got to kind of salute the people who stuck it out. But
yes, Godspeed.
Yeah, John Carroll was like, nope. That's yeah, bad finales, they're a thing. They happen. It's tough.
Yes.
If you hang until the end hoping for something and then you get a bad finale, it's...
Look no further than Dexter.
Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. I gave up on Dexter like three seasons ago. Yeah. So, speaking of the Chronicle, we should at least mention and mark the moment. Your old boss and successor as TV critic at the Chronicle, David Wiegand, passed away a couple weeks ago. And there's nice pieces on the Chronicle about him. I remember when you left the Chronicle, you're like, I don't know what they're going to do there. And your boss was like, I'm going to step up. I'm going to do the TV critic thing. And he did.
Yeah, and I did a little bit of a I wrote something for the TCA membership, sort of recalling my time there with David as my boss. And I mean, he's a guy who was tireless in his arts coverage as the editor, and then he just took more and more on. I mean, he was definitely a workaholic, but he really enjoyed it, and he was all over the map. He was at the symphony and plays, and he was, you know, art galleries and television, and we just didn't know how he did it, especially when I left and took it over. But he was watching a lot of TV when I was the critic. One thing I pointed out in my, or at least I said, that I'll always be thankful to David for when I was at the Chronicle, is that he saved me countless really, really stupid editor ideas that floated down in the morning meeting or were about to float down, and he said, nope, not happening. Because these guys weren't watching television, and they were like, have Tim do this, or I read in the New York Times today this thing, and he'd say, Tim did that 2 months ago. You know, it's like, he saved me a lot, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I'll put a link into one of the appreciations. I remember him as the arts writer, and so I was always kind of fascinated when he would write a TV story, because he had been... That was sort of like, in addition to being the editor, that like he was writing those fine art kind of stories. And so when you left and he took on TV, I was like, okay, the arts writer is going to write about TV. And, you know, he did a great job. I don't know how he did it either in terms of the time. Just amazing. But
tell me about it.
That was, I should also, while we're in the San Francisco Chronicle section, I have to mention Peter Hartlaub, who was kind of a character via his cousin on the old TV talk machine. He and one of his Chronicle colleagues wrote every Muni line a couple weeks ago too.
Yes,
in Total Muni 2018.
Total Muni.
Mm-hmm. I Peter Hartlaub, who has a podcast, because again, he's the trailblazer that he reignited the Chronicle podcast wave that was first ignited by the TV talk machine so long ago. They also have by the way, I saw today on my Twitter stream from Henry Schulman at the Chronicle, the Giants beat writer, that they have a Giants podcast that they've had for about 5 months now, still on SoundCloud, still not available on iTunes.
Unbelievable.
So the Chronicle remains the Chronicle, is what I'm saying.
Chronicle. Don't ever change, Chronicle.
Amazing. Like we got back. Good news. We got back into podcasting. Bad news. They're not actually podcasting half of them because they're not on iTunes.
We don't really know what podcasting is, but we're into it again.
Again. My favorite thing about the Chronicle at all was that thing that went before the beginning of some episodes of TVTM original, where it was an executive at the Chronicle saying, you're listening to a podcast. Like, you could hear in his voice complete mystification about what he was saying. It's amazing. I don't understand what you're about to listen to. Enjoy, that kind of thing. Amazing. All right. Donnie in the 206 wrote in to say, I'm ready to agree with the last episode's letter about American Crime Story Versace being the best show of 2018. I feel that it probably got overlooked because it tells a very specific, heartbreaking, and deeply queer story about LGBTQ lives in the 90s, which made it more of a niche entertainment among the largely straight male TV critic community, which leads me to a broader question. Have you ever had trouble reviewing a show because you felt too far removed from its target audience? What do you think?
Well, first, let me go back and say, what did this person say? Largely male, heterosexual?
Straight male TV critic community.
That is clearly not true. That person has not been around television critics. That is definitely not true. There are tons of female critics. There are tons of gay critics, and always have been. So that is definitely...
I thought you might not let that statement go.
Nope,
but
nope, that's factually inaccurate. But no, I think that you can. I mean, what it's the human experience. I mean, there's you have to be able to identify, even if you are not that. Otherwise, I could only review things about a straight white male. But, and I couldn't review anything with women in it because I'm not a woman. So no, that's, I don't subscribe to that at all. I mean, I think there's times when it would be better if someone did it. You could also make the argument that it's not better because it's a person is too close to the subject matter or is, so it's such an agenda for them that maybe it would be too close to them and they couldn't see it just based on this is a TV show, have at it. So cause some things were just too hot buttony. But no, I think people, I don't, you know, you have to be able to think about like a kid thinks or like a teenage girl, you have to be able to have all this. And you have to at least have some life experience or some empathy and acknowledge that other people are out there. This is true in arts throughout the world, and throughout time. So it's not something specific to us.
Well, and ultimately, you know, every critic that's out there, they are giving their personal perspective on it, and they do try to. I think the best critics do have empathy. They're able to understand, who is this made for? Why, you know, who would like it? And I can tell you that from somebody writing about computer things, it's the same thing, which is the worst critics are the ones who cannot step outside themselves. And everything they write is literally, could I use this? Is this for me? And that's not, right. If you're better, you think, who is this for? Mm-hmm. What is this person trying to say? What audiences are going to appreciate this? I always like that, like back in the day, Siskel and Ebert, they would talk about movies, like action movies and kids movies and stuff like that. And people be like, I can't believe you gave a thumbs up to, I think what Ebert liked Benji the Hunted at one point. And he's like, it's a kids movie. Kids will like it. Like, I mean, it's pretty simple. I could see a scenario where you watch something and you're like, whoa, I don't understand this. Like, this is not from my worldview. But in the end, when I read your reviews, I'm reading your reviews, they come from you. And if I read Dan Feinberg's, they come from him. And if I read like Mo Ryan's reviews, they're going to come from her perspective, which is very different. But that's just, every TV critic in the end, the lie is that it's some sort of universal view. And it's not. It's one person's view.
Yeah. And I would just add to what I had said previously in that, does a person who's let's say in the LGBTQ community, or does a young African American writer, or does even like a teenage girl, if she was going to like write a review of a CW show, would those be better? I would certainly say that they would be much different than probably anybody else, no matter their ethnicity or sex, would do. So it'd be a different perspective because it's closer to the subject matter. And so it would be different. I think it's great to have those competing perspectives. You don't always get them, but I think that, if you look, you'll find them.
Hmm. All right, let's move on to Victoria, who wrote in and said, as a huge fan of The Americans, I'm blown away by the quality of the final season. Each episode seems better than the one before. I would love for a wider audience to have enjoyed this gem. It makes me wonder if in this age of confusion, peak TV and streaming, a show like this can be discovered by a much broader audience after its run is over, like what happened with The Wire. What do you think?
Specifically which show or all shows?
Well, The Americans, I think, and maybe you could broaden it, but like, can a show like The Americans that has its viewership now, when it's a complete entity and it's sitting on streaming somewhere, does it have a chance to be, to over time reach be discovered and reach
absolutely.
A much broader audience?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the great thing about having, because it used to be you'd have to watch in reruns and then you only reran it for a little bit, and certainly serialized stuff like The Americans was hardly ever rerun, but so streaming services now have a home for them and you can watch them when you want to. Even like cable channels have their own places to go back, although weirdly a lot of the seasons are not available. But in the broader picture, I mean, that's why like Rectify, I've always I remember talking to those guys at Rectify and saying, a lot of critics obviously feel that everybody should watch this, that it's brilliant. But four seasons later, it's over, but like, it's like writing a book. You put it on the shelf and people are going to discover it at some point. You can't make it a popular hit after the fact, and that's somebody else's loss, but it's there, and that's the great thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've talked about this before. I think about Sense8 when they announced that they're going to do that they did the conclusion movie, like to wrap it up. That I also think there is value in a complete work, and that there are audiences I hear from them who don't want to watch a show if it's in risk of being canceled. The problem is it will get canceled if nobody watches it. So you should watch, if there's a show you're interested in, you should watch it. But I know that there are audiences who will look at something and say, oh, here it is. It's this many seasons. It's this many episodes. It's done. It had a conclusion. Now I can watch the whole thing, and they'll binge through it in a short amount of time. I do think that there's like this bonus added value you get. It becomes more attractive if it's a complete package that's done. And I think that when The Americans finishes and goes off to the great, you know, streaming library in the sky, that I think there will be a lot of people who will jump in there. In fact, I wonder if you ought to do maybe there's a piece in there too, like the complete sets, like something that's a complete set that you could watch all of. I don't know.
I know, right?
We'll see. In 6 months, there'll be a story, and you'll be like, oh, this is like something from the podcast. Like, oh, yeah. I don't know. I just think there's an inherent value in a completed work that a lot of people just really get excited by the fact that they know how long it is and that it's finished. Go figure. Okay, I've got two more. Patrick from the 408, who escaped to the 802, says, Tim's five shows to reboot included several shows my wife and I have on our list of great shows we wish would come back. However, he missed a great idea from the past that would seem to be a natural solution for several of the TV problems in these times of confusion. I'm surprised he missed it, considering how often you two invoke Columbo. What about The Wheel? The best example of which was the NBC Sunday Mystery Movie. With shows doing shorter seasons and show discovery being a problem, it seems like a network could group together three or four thematically similar shows. I'd be more likely to turn on NBC or CBS if I knew that every Thursday at 9:30, I could see a new episode of a show I'd probably like. If someone brings back the Mystery Movie, I hope that a reboot of Banachek starring George Clooney is in the offing. I wonder what it all means, Patrick. I don't know about, I kind of like this idea, but I feel like with DVRs and stuff in the modern era, it's much more likely that you'd do a short run show and then ideally like follow it with another run of a short run show rather than having them. The Wheel was like one a month, where like there would, 1 week there'd be Columbo and then the next week there would be McMillan and Wife or whatever, and it would kind of keep going like that. David Lohr, if he were here, could tell you exactly what the Mystery Movie shows were. I can't. So,
and stage them.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Right. It's kind of a neat idea. This goes back to our, us talking about, he's writing the Mystery Movie Wheel right now. Yeah. This goes back to our idea of playlists too, like streaming playlists, like the idea of like, well, if you like this show, then continue on with this other show. I don't think the wheel itself is viable today, but, you know, also we're talking about tuning in at a time on a day. I don't do that anymore. I gotta be honest. Right. That is also gone.
That's gone.
But I do think the networks, you know, they want to program like things because they want people to kind of like stay with the brand and stay with the shows. But I don't know. Maybe the time of the Mystery Movie has passed. Last is a tweet from Jason Barry on Twitter, who said, I won't believe we've reached peak TV until gas station TV orders original scripted programming. And that's it. If you would like your dumb thoughts transcribed on the TVTM, you can tweet at us at TVTM, or you can email us at podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. And we will be back hopefully next week. We got some scheduling to do, but we'll hopefully put that together. Anything else before we go, Tim? I want to give you some space for your Mystery Movie Wheel Columboing.
I would just say that maybe that gas TV thing is brilliant. Maybe that is a brilliant thought that was put out there.
Gas station TV
as a
scripted program.
Yeah. So, like, if you we take all comments. I think there we may look back on that and say, remember when that scripted thing happened?
Yeah, there'll be that moment.
People were filling their gas tank up, chopping it off because they had to see the next episode, and they only had a half a tank, and they kept going back.
Yeah.
Could be the next.
That's sure. I'm imagining John Landgraf sitting at the TCA and saying, look, gas station TV, I don't even know what's going on anymore, and just walking out. That's what I picture there.
Yeah, Forget it.
It's over. All right. Well, we will be back hopefully next week. And until then, thanks to everybody out there for listening, including those people in Australia. Keep staying alive out there in Australia. Watch out. There's spiders and snakes and sharks, and the list goes on. Drop bears. And until next week, Tim, it's been a pleasure as always. Have a good weekend.
All right. You too. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.